He had. When the true story emerged, it was like, as Mr. Bagthorpe observed, something straight out of Dracula. "We are embarked on a full-scale tilt into the macabre," he declared, "and I shudder to think how this family might end up. What in the name of the devil have we spawned?" "Only William," Rosie protested. "Greedy thing." "It was not greed," corrected her father. "It was nothing like so simple as that. It was sheer, blind, carnivorous craving. It was a primitive bloodlust." Jack thought Mr. Bagthorpe was exaggerating, in that William had not killed the chops, merely eaten them. He guessed, rightly, that his father was chagrined that he had not thought of this idea first. "He consumed them at midnight," Mr. Bagthorpe continued. "At dead of night he conducted this grisly post-mortem. I suspect that he did not even use a knife and fork. I suspect that he held them in his fingers and tore at the flesh. Did you, by any chance, devour them raw?" "I grilled them," William replied, "and I had mint sauce with the lamb ones. They're the best thing I've had for days. I ate every single chop she buried, if you want to know." He was not at all repentant, and refused to allow that there was anything satanic or even macabre about his actions. "The chops had merely been laid in the cool earth, rather than a fridge," he said, "as they would have been before fridges were invented. You are just jealous, because you didn't think of it yourselves." They were, of course, almost to a man, with the exception of Mrs. Bagthorpe, Daisy, and Grandma, the latter secure in her possession of a Fortnum and Mason hamper. Rosie would dearly have liked a grilled chop, but certainly not at the expense of hurting Daisy's feelings. "Poor little Daisy! You never thought of her!" she shrieked at William. "I did not," he assented. "I never gave her a second's thought. I put the graves back how they were, and if she hadn't gone poking around, she'd never have known. It's her that's morbid." "It's not! It's not! She cried and cried and cried. She thinks that all the things she's buried have vanished into thin air for ever and ever, and now she's really upset." "What she was probably looking for," William continued, "was maggots." "She wasn't, then. She thinks things turn to dusters and ashes, and I think it's really sweet, and—" "I think we are going round in circles," Mr. Bagthorpe intervened. "You know, don't you," addressing himself to William, "that your grandmother is talking of cutting you out of her will. I should have thought that a high price to pay for a couple of clandestine chops." "And Daisy's going to train little Tommy up to scratch you," Rosie put in, "and bite you, and it'll serve you right." Grandma and Daisy had certainly been holed up in the former's room once the initial furor died down. Grandma had been extremely scathing prior to her withdrawal. "You have betrayed at a stroke, the innocent dreams of a little child," she told William. "That is the eighth and the most heinous of the seven deadly sins. You should wear sackcloth and ashes for the rest of your days." Her Old Testament line and the unfortunate reference to ashes made no impression at all on William, and served only to heighten Daisy's hysteria. "I fought things turned to dusters and ashes," she sobbed, "and now they don't, and I'm not having funerals any more. I hate funerals." "Of course you do not, dear child," Grandma told her, "and of course things turn to dusters and ashes, if they are not interfered with. We shall hold many more lovely funerals and put this whole sordid business behind us." "I'm going to tell 'Arry 'Awk," Daisy wailed, unsoothed. At this, all present, including Grandma, stiffened. If the exhumation of the chops had brought about the resurrection of 'Arry 'Awk, who had been inconspicuous by his absence of late, then things were taking a more dangerous turn. He was, they well knew, the most malignant and slippery member of the unholy alliance. Despite his invisibility to the eyes of anyone but Daisy, he certainly knew how to make his presence felt. He also enabled Daisy and Grandma to perpetrate whatever atrocities they chose, and then disclaim all responsibility by blaming them all on the tireless 'Arry 'Awk. "'Arry 'Awk is the archetypal can-carrier of all time," Mr. Bagthorpe would declare. "I should know. I am one myself." "If 'Arry 'Awk is again among us," he now said, "we must look to ourselves. We are already beset with cannibalism," meaning presumably William, "and saboteurs," meaning Daisy and Grandma. Now we have a hell-raising entity who will strike at any time from all sides. Mayhem will break loose." A profound silence followed this statement. It was broken by the rattling of the doorknob that heralded the arrival of Mrs. Fosdyke. The Bagthorpes tried to rally themselves into some kind of appearance of normality, but failed signally. "Morning!" Mrs. Fosdyke kept shooting suspicious looks at them as she whipped about, donning her overall and fur-edged slippers. The Bagthorpes, in their strenuous effort to look normal, in fact, appeared less so than usual. Grandma rose. "Come, Daisy," she said. "We will leave others to explain to Mrs. Fosdyke the grisly proceedings of the past few days. She may wish to consider seriously whether or not she wishes to be attached to such a household." Having made this intentionally inflammatory speech, she withdrew, taking Daisy with her. "What's been going on, then?" demanded Mrs. Fosdyke flatly. "Nothing," replied the young Bagthorpes in unison. Unlovable as Mrs. Fosdyke was, she could at least do more with rhubarb and beetroot than any of themselves. She had even produced a moderately acceptable soup with the latter. "What's on for today, then?" Mrs. Fosdyke asked. "It's never lettuce and onions again." "I had rather thought a salad at lunch," Mrs. Bagthorpe said apologetically, "and then this evening I thought an omelette." "An omelette?" Rosie echoed. "One omelette between us all?" "Don't be an idiot," William told her. "Have you forgotten the hens are coming today?" "My chickens!" she exclaimed joyously. "Hurrah! I'm going to give them all names and call them, and I'm going to fill my apron with corn, and they'll all come running to me." "I should not become too involved with them, Rosie dear," advised Mrs. Bagthorpe, worried by this speech. "They are not to be pets, remember, but productive members of the menage. They are coming for a purpose." Rosie had clearly overlooked the undoubted fact that these hens, having produced their eggs, would almost certainly end up in a casserole, given that they were able to bypass Daisy. "I've thought of lots of names already," she continued happily, appearing not to have heard what her mother had said. "Biddy, and Cluck, and Speckles, and Blackie. But I'll wait till I see their faces before I decide, so's they'll have names to really suit them." Mr. Bagthorpe rose. "Cease your prattling," he told Rosie. "Those hens are here to lay eggs, not to feature in a Walt Disney film. And you, William, get on to that prophet fellow in Grimsby and see if you can't get him to catch some kippers. We're clean out of them. Tell him to let his everlasting alien intelligence go get on with it by itself and get catching some kippers." "You don't catch kippers," William told him. Mr. Bagthorpe stared at him. "Shoot them, perhaps?" he inquired sarcastically. "There are no kippers in the sea," William said. "Look," said Mr. Bagthorpe, "I may not be the young brain of Britain, but I do happen to know that the North Sea is full of kippers, and that Grimsby is the place where they pull them all in." William, who was in no mood to explain to his father the process whereby a herring becomes a kipper, himself rose. "I am glad you reminded me of the young brain of Britain," he said. "It's on tonight. I am going to have one last shot at blacking the wavelength." "Do you really think you should, dear?" Mrs. Bagthorpe was anxious about this. She genuinely believed that her elder son was capable of plunging Britain into total silence on the Radio 2 network, and was fearful of the repercussions of this action. "Just leave it to me, Mother," William told her loftily. "No need to get in a stew." He went out. "Stew," came Mrs. Fosdyke's disillusioned voice. "That'll be the day."